This is a Carlisle ValueCast, brought to you by the Carlisle Group. ValueCast brings you insights from our One Carlisle network, providing analysis, data, and observations to help you navigate the global economy and top-of-mind issues in news. The Carlisle Group. Invest wisely. Create value.
Greetings and welcome to Carlisle ValueCast. I'm Chris Ullman, head of Carlisle's Global Communications. Today, we're delighted to welcome Rob Stuckey, head of Carlisle's U.S. real estate team, for his first appearance on ValueCast. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you, Chris.
Rob, it is a delight to spend time with you here to learn about your new fund and your team and the outlook for the market here in the United States. So you just raised $5.5 billion to invest in the United States. So tell us all about that. Why that size fund and what you're going to do with the money and types of investors?
We're one of the only U.S.-focused real estate opportunity funds that have a fund of that size. And we have a deep team that has continuity and market presence. Our team consists of 100 investment professionals. I've been the fund head for 20 years now. And over that period of time, we've made approaching 700 investments. We've realized 450 of them. And through those experiences, we've developed a unique approach. We have a way of systematically and comprehensively assessing all sectors and markets, and we construct our funds with an eye toward producing premium returns, but also managing risk.
You just raised $5.5 billion. What are you going to do with that money?
We have a distinctive approach to real estate investing. As an opportunistic fund, we focus as much on managing risk as we do enhanced returns. And toward that end, we're very focused on how we construct our funds. And that includes three considerations. First, prudent leverage. Second, we maintain low concentration. And third, we choose sectors with an eye toward achieving some measure of non-correlation to GDP-driven cyclical risk. Cyclical risk is the paramount consideration for real estate investors, and we believe that that is primarily addressed through sector selection.
So as you move from investing Fund 7 to Fund 8, do you anticipate your strategy changing?
With each successive fund, we're considering the risk and the growth opportunities in that time period. And the growth opportunities as a baseline are generally defined by GDP. GDP is currently range-bound at a meager level between 2 and 3%. So our objective is to find pockets of demand that exceed that level and do so on a predictive basis. The primary risk with real estate investing is cyclical risk, and we're also conscious of that, and the way we try to deal with that is through fund construction with an eye toward choosing sectors that achieve some measure of non-correlation to cyclical risk. So the thing that changes as you go through time is growth potential and cyclical risk. The growth potential for each vintage is a little different. Cyclical risk is a little different. And accordingly, the fund construction needs to be adjusted.
Now, you mentioned fund construction. What does that mean? Do you try to get different sectors, different geographies, different size investments to actually create this construction?
Yes. So there are different perspectives in thinking about fund construction. One is the sector allocation. Another is the geographic allocation. Another is our concentration by deal. In the end, we're thinking not only about our overall forecasted return for the fund, but the range of it and how that will play in various economic cycles. So by diversifying and by including certain investments that have some degree of non-correlation, we believe we can narrow the range of the fund and not be overly exposed to any particular position, create incremental optionality, and hopefully tilt the fund in a positive direction.
Give us an idea of the types of sectors as well as geographically where you think you'll deploy that money.
So if you imagine the U.S. along two dimensions, sector and geography, and with real estate, there are about 12 sectors and there are about 30 major metro markets. So that creates a grid of about 360 nodes. And we believe we have one of the only U.S.-focused opportunity fund teams that's able to systematically and comprehensively assess that entire grid and analyze each node on a fairly granular basis. And when we analyze each node on the grid, we have an eye toward determining where fundamentals are likely to be underpriced by capital markets. So when we consider the sectors, we consider the underlying demand drivers. And each sector is either driven primarily by demographics or GDP. And one of the things we've tried to do over the years is increasingly tilt our funds towards sectors driven in large part by demographics, which is particularly important as we go later into the cycle, because cycles are driven by fluctuations in GDP, and to the extent that we're able to invest in sectors that have some degree of non-correlation to GDP through demographics, we're able to mitigate cyclical risk.
So is this a way to get around just the cycles of the economy?
We never completely get around the cycles of the economy, but it's paramount objective to mitigate the cyclicality of our funds. We, over the last 20 years, have invested through nearly three full cycles, two recessions, including the Great Recession. And when you're going through a recession, the primary thing that you think about and focus on is how to fill up your properties. And toward that end, you're always focused on the root demand drivers. In the end, the root demand drivers are either coming from GDP or demographics. Technology is another factor. It ultimately shifts demand from one sector to another. So, for example, right now, technology is shifting demand from retail to industrial as e-commerce and fulfillment centers change the distribution of retail products.
Millennials and boomers. You got 100 million millennials that are either in the market or entering the market. What are the implications of that for your business?
Millennials are entering adulthood, and preference changes as they go through life. So a millennial that is 34 may be having his or her first child, which may necessitate owning a home rather than renting a home. So that's an important milestone that affects the percentage of the population that rents versus own, and that's an important thing to track. And that is different depending on which city we're talking about. So that's a way to track with some degree of predictability this concept of rentership and home ownership. Home ownership has been declining since the Great Recession, and that will start reversing itself a little bit as millennials age. Millennials otherwise have a strong propensity to rent housing in urban locations, and that's increasingly shifting to suburban locations. Millennials are expected to produce 2.7 million renter households over the next decade, and their preferences are changing, and we're monitoring those preferences, and those inferences are different market by market. So you can't really generalize across the country. You have to analyze this on a market by market basis.
How about for boomers in terms of the real estate opportunity?
Baby boomers show a strong propensity to own homes, but have, despite that, shown an increasing propensity to rent homes. So the rentership of baby boomers has increased from something like 18% 5 years ago to 25% today. So although it's a relatively low percentage, it's still an increase. When you apply that to the large number of retiring baby boomers, we expect there to be something like 200,000 units of rental demand just from the baby boomer age cohort. And baby boomers have a very specific set of preferences as it relates to rental product. They want vibrant urban locations. They want all of it at an attractive value proposition. And they want some services as well. So that creates a dearth of what we call active adult rental apartments. In the U.S., there are only 180,000 active adult apartments, and those are 97% occupied. So as you can see, we're poised to experience pent-up demand as it relates to active adult. So active adult apartments are age-restricted apartments with a light touch of services, not to be confused with independent living, and their rents are 40% lower than independent living and target a younger age cohort than independent living.
So what type of investors commit that capital to your fund?
We have a range of investors, institutional investors, sovereign wealth funds, high net worth, domestic and foreign. So we have over a 20-year period, a good following of investors. And so it's a broad range. About 60% of our investors are U.S.-based.
Now, you've mentioned your team. Clearly, talent is critical here as you're kind of surveying the whole country for these 300-plus nodes you talked about. Tell us a little bit about kind of the continuity of that team.
Well, I've been the fund head for 20 years, and our senior leadership team's been in place about that period of time. And we generally promote from within, so at all levels we have continuity. And that's important because we develop strategies across sectors and by market, and it's important to have local credibility. So having made nearly 700 investments over the last 20 years, we have gained a certain degree of local credibility, which can lead to off-market investing opportunities, which of course can be quite valuable.
Now, you have 16 managing directors on your team with an average of 27 years of real estate experience and average of 16 years at Carlyle. That's incredible. How did you create that team?
The number that we're particularly proud of is the amount of time at Carlyle working together, because that continuity of working together creates the ability to communicate shorthand, the ability to efficiently make investments, and to benefit from institutional knowledge.
Earlier you mentioned the word opportunity investing. So give us a little primer on the different types of real estate investing in the United States, especially at the level you're at.
There's no monolithic answer to real estate investing because there are 12 sectors and 30 major metro markets, and those 12 sectors consist of conventional commercial real estate investing, office, hotel, retail, industrial, but also less conventional sectors like manufactured housing, student housing, senior living, active adult, and several others, data centers, for example. So there's a variety of real estate sectors. Each has its own driver of demand, and each has its own economic dynamics as well as cyclicality. Generally, we're looking to construct a fund that has diversification, diversification by sector, by geography, and also we try to maintain low concentration on an individual investment basis, and that reduces our exposure to any particular position.
So let's talk about the two types of funds that you have. You have an opportunistic fund, and then you have the so-called core plus. So what would be kind of an archetypical opportunistic deal versus a archetypical core plus deal? How would they differ from each other?
The typical opportunistic deal will take some form of leasing risk or construction risk. So those are the two types of risk, either what I would call balance sheet risk, which is changing the physicality of the asset, or income statement risk, which is changing the income level of the asset. The degree of the risk is greater with opportunistic than with core plus. So with core plus, the idea is to only do minor repositioning with respect to either the physical asset or its income level. So another important consideration, though, is that with each strategy, we're generally applying the same fund construction principles. Fund construction principles, again, managing leverage prudently, maintain low concentration, and choosing sectors with an eye toward achieving some non-correlation to cyclical risk. And those fund construction principles have served us well over multiple cycles, and they apply to both core plus and opportunistic. The difference, though, is at the asset level, we're taking less risk with respect to leasing and construction with core plus as opposed to opportunistic.
So on an opportunistic deal, if you were to build a high rise from scratch, would that be opportunistic or core plus?
That would be opportunistic, because any ground up development would be in the opportunistic category.
And then in a core plus type deal, what might be a good example of that?
So we have several manufactured housing investments, which is a sector we like a lot because we believe that's a demographic-driven sector. Why? Because manufactured housing serves as a source of affordable housing for retiring baby boomers, which is a trend that's going to continue irrespective of whether we experience a recession. Second, many of those investments offer attractive mark-to-market opportunities and benefit from favorable and sustainable supply and demand dynamics, because zoning restrictions inhibit further construction of those kinds of properties. So there are many things about manufactured housing that lower the risk while still providing attractive returns, and those generally fit well within our Core Plus fund.
What is manufactured housing?
Manufactured housing can mean a variety of things, but the type that we pursue are those communities that target 55-plus populations. They're often considered to be trailer parks, but the type that we're investing in are more permanent structures. They're considered to be prefabricated and movable. So manufactured housing is generally affordable housing for retiring baby boomers, and we try to buy properties that are in places where people want to retire.
So even if we went into a recession, there will still be 100 million millennials, and there'll still be 70 plus million boomers. So there are real estate implications of that, I presume.
Right. And millennials and baby boomers need places to live, and they have very specific and predictable preferences. So that can lead to interesting strategies. Now, we're not saying that a recession wouldn't adversely affect some of those investing strategies, but we think that the effect would be shorter and shallower than, say, for example, if we owned an office building, which we think is highly correlated with GDP and therefore is very much affected by a recession.
Now, Rob, you and I have known each other for almost 17 years now, and I would say you're easily considered one of the most focused and disciplined people at Carlyle. Why are you like that?
Well, I don't know why I'm like that, but the objective, I think, in the end is to provide a good product for ultimately our LPs, but Carlyle. And so every day we face a competitive environment and therefore need to be focused in order to have an edge.
What you're describing sounds like pattern recognition. So over the 20-year period, at what point would you say that the way you do it today effectively began?
It's been a continual and cumulative refinement of our approach. So, for example, to have a team that has as much continuity as we have is a cumulative thing, and that continuity leads to institutional knowledge and learning. But I would say there's a moment in the last 20 years that was particularly impactful, which was the Great Recession. So during 2008, 2009, real estate values were severely affected. Real estate was really at the epicenter of the Great Recession. And so when you're operating a closed-end fund that has some amount of leverage and your values are affected by the recession, you need to have a clear path towards resolution of that because you have a lot of pressure. And so the first step along that path is the understanding of the demand factors, because the demand factors are what lease the properties. Ultimately, real estate's a capacity utilization business, and you need to fill up the properties, and you need to know where that demand's coming from, which in turn produces revenue, and revenue is ultimately the engine that drives the resolution of that sort of situation. So that led to even sharper understanding of where the demand is coming from and how to tailor our investments to get even more attractive returns when adjusted for risk.
Rob, you have a really interesting background. You were an NCAA academic All-American football player at Nebraska. Then you went on to Harvard Business School. So clearly those are challenging environments. So what did you learn and how did you behave in those environments that have helped you be a good investor?
Well, I think everyone's background contributes to where they are today. And anytime you face challenges early in your life, it gives you discipline and focus toward achieving success. In my job, we're trying to consistently achieve premium returns while managing risk. We're trying to outperform the market. And the market doesn't readily yield outperformance. And outperformance only comes from consistently refining our strategies and refining our approach to the market. And so that requires constant vigilance, but it also requires discipline to think about what we could do differently and discipline to improve. Facing challenges forces you to be introspective and forces you to seek improvement.
Now that you've raised this new pot of capital, how do you feel about it?
We feel responsible. It's a privilege to manage a $5.5 billion fund, and our objective is to produce outperformance. And toward that end, we want to produce outperformance not just with premium returns, but premium returns when adjusted for risk.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to our website at www.carlyle.com. This has been a Carlyle ValueCast podcast.